As a matter of statistics, of demographics, there is no denying the fact that there are more women in church on any given Sunday than there are men. It's really quite outstanding. If you were to walk into any Christian church on Sunday morning, likely you would see more females than men, and the proportions might shock you if you just took a time to count up. You got women and children and fewer men. So those who measure such things are telling us. Why is this? Why are men not feeling at home in church? Should they feel at home in church? Why are the leadership roles in church so often now occupied by women rather than men? Is this how things ought to be? Does the issue of masculinity have anything to do with the feminization of the church? Have we lost what it is that the scriptures present as genuine masculinity? God did, after all, create man male and female, didn't he? We're going to talk about biblical masculinity in this hour of Issues, Etc., the feminization of the culture and of the church. I'm Todd Wilkin. My guest during this hour, Douglas Wilson. He's author of the book Future Men. He's pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho, and editor of Credenda Agenda magazine. Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. Doug, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you.
Doug, what is the best example you can think of the feminization of the church in particular?
Well, I would say that the most visible place where the feminization of the church is apparent is in the alteration of how we worship. The effects of the feminization of the church is seen over centuries, where men have not felt as comfortable, at least in Western forms of Christianity, as elsewhere in the world. But the place where you can see it most visibly is in the relational aspect that worship services have taken over.
What do you mean by relational aspect?
Well, in the old Western model, the masculine model, what you would have is an emissary from God, the minister, who would come to declare the word of God, declare the gospel to the people. And he would announce all sorts of things in the most insensitive way possible, and you just sort of had to deal with it. But now, pastors sit on stools and wear Mr. Rogers cardigan sweaters and stroll back and forth with their hands in their pockets and chat with the people. And this sort of face-to-face relational model is not the dialogue of covenant renewal. It's the it's exhibit A in the feminization of the church.
So, in other words, would you contend that in the worship life of the church, this was not only an old model, this was, in fact, a model that comported better with what the church's task is on Sunday morning than the pastor sitting on a stool or strolling to and fro among the congregation?
Yes, very much so.
What about the theology of the Bible gives us an insight into... And I use the word insight very reluctantly, but gives us a picture of biblical masculinity. Where does it begin?
Well, I think the most obvious thing that we have to look to is the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven." And then Jesus is the one who said, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." Jesus is the bridegroom. The church is our mother. The church provides us with the model of femininity, but God and Christ provide us with the ultimate model of what masculinity is to be like. And men and women both participate in the bride. Collectively, together, we are feminine. But it's very interesting that God has set before us, he's revealed himself to us as a father, and has sent his son to be our bridegroom. And so that's the ultimate model of masculinity, and this is why the feminists are quite right to be up in arms about pronouns in the Bible. They know what's at issue.
You mean they're quite right in the sense that that these pronouns matter?
Yes, that's what they're right about. They're not right about removing them, of course, but they're right in seeing that the Bible, as it was given to us, is not an egalitarian book.
Now, someone's going to say, Doug, certainly you know that God is spirit, and therefore he is neither male nor female.
Correct. Maleness and femaleness are an accident of biology. I'm using accident in the older Aristotelian sense. They're a function of biology. But God, who is spirit, nonetheless reveals himself to us as Father. And what that tells me is that masculinity and femininity are not biological traits. They are traits that male and female biological entities can partake in, but God, who is ultimately spirit, is God of spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Nevertheless, this God is masculine and reveals himself to us as a father. And that means our earthly biological fathers are not more masculine than God the Father. They are less masculine. As Paul says in Ephesians, all fatherhood derives its name and identity from God the Father.
Can you define in a nutshell biblical masculinity?
Yes, my understanding of the scripture is that masculinity is authoritative, it takes responsibility and the initiative. Femininity is responsive to the initiative, so the masculine initiates, the feminine responds. The masculine exercises authority, the feminine submits to authority. And so in that sense, a father and a son, for example, the father's masculine and the son, although male, is feminine in that relation. And or a husband and wife who have little kids, the parents are masculine over against the kids, who are feminine, even if the kids happen to be little boys. So consequently, I don't identify masculinity and femininity with male and female at all. But we have to recognize that God has told the female in a marriage relationship to occupy the feminine position and the male to occupy the masculine.
So we have, I'm trying to put my finger on this, we have a not only a biological fact with which we as partakers of God's creation are faced with. There's a biological maleness and a biological femaleness. But you were saying that Scripture also describes a transcendent maleness and females, which derives from God the Father himself and his relationship to his creation, to his people, he Redeemer, we the saved, things like this.
Correct. The ultimate reality is the triune God. He is the uncreated reality. And within the Godhead, we have every ultimate archetype. When this God created the world, that world was embedded with the characteristics of God are revealed in the created order. And they are revealed in many varied and wonderful ways. And so, but the one thing we can't do is we can't make it an egalitarian level playing field.
In a cultural sense, Doug, why has masculinity fallen on hard times?
Well, in the book that I in The Future Men, when I was addressing this, I was dependent for my analysis at this point on a fine book by Leon Podlos. The name of the book is The Church Impotent.
Yeah, I've talked with Dr. Podlos. That's a fantastic book. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is, and I'm following him here, and I think that he's right on the money when he says that the individualization of devotion, which took the feminine response away from the church and into everybody's private quiet time, everybody's private devotion, created an enormous problem for pious men. Because I have no problem going to worship in the church, in the liturgy of the church, and seeing myself as part of the bride of Christ, because this is a corporate reality, and men and women both can make up this feminine reality called the bride of Christ. But if I go off into my own room and individualize it, and I as a male try to act like a bride, I just can't do it. I've got one of two problems. Either I can't do it, in which case I'll be discouraged and leave the church, or I can do it, which is another problem.
Now, you have said that young boys in particular are faced with two a false dichotomy by our culture and sometimes even by the proclamation of our church and the way our church behaves, and that is, on the one hand, effeminacy, and on the other hand, kind of a machismo. Describe those two.
Right. The effeminacy is where everybody's pushing boys and men to go down that track, and sometimes when boys revolt against this full court press to make them effeminate, they don't have any godly role models that show them what true biblical masculinity looks like, and so they adopt a counterfeit masculinity, which is the swagger of a machismo approach. And I think this is just unbelieving alternative to feminism. I call it masculinism, and this masculinism is no more masculine than feminism is. So what I think has to happen is we have to go back to the scriptures and understand what is true masculinity in a father and in a husband and in a son. What does masculinity look like? And in my view, masculinity, the essence of masculinity, is the assumption of responsibility.
Now, before we go to this break, what's at stake here, really? I mean, we can talk about masculinity for the sake of cultural ends, or for the sake of raising boys to be effective citizens or leaders or titans of industry or something like that. But what is really at stake for the Christian church on this issue of the loss of masculinity?
Well, I think that quite honestly, I think that what's at stake is the health and survival of the church in our culture, in our time. I don't have any doubts about the survival of the church in history, in human history, because Christ said the gates of hell will not prevail against it. But I do have doubts about the survival of the church in America today. And this is because the church, although we are very numerous and we've got a lot of people involved, we are selling our soul. And I believe the evangelical church is where liberalism was in the 1930s, and we have accommodated ourselves to the world, and I think nothing good can come from it.
My guest is Doug Wilson. He's pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho, editor of Credenda Agenda magazine, and author of this book called Future Men. We're talking about biblical masculinity, the feminization of the culture, and the church. We'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence, because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues Etc.
Folks, if you'd like to know how to purchase Doug Wilson's book called Future Men, you can call 1-800-488-2034. That's 1-800-488-2034. The book is called Future Men by my guest in this hour, Doug Wilson. Our phone number, if you have a question or comment for us as we talk about biblical masculinity, 1-800-730-2727. I want to pick up on something you said right before the break, Doug, and that has to do with pop evangelicalism, kind of I don't even know what to call this, the amorphous mass of popular Christianity. You talked before about the nature of Christian worship, how it has been feminized into kind of this relational model rather than a proclamational model. Where else in the life of the church, beyond Sunday morning, do we find this feminization, this creeping feminization?
You mean where in our current life?
Yes.
Where things are going on right now?
Absolutely.
Well, I believe that one of the things we've seen is we don't just have the relational therapeutic model in liturgy, which has begun to happen, which, of course, is, you know, obviously therapy has its place, but the therapeutic model for life is problematic and has taken over liturgy. Women are gifted by God at many things, and when we start acting like babies, all of us, this gives authority to women because women are good with kids. And if we're acting like kids, then this is what's going to happen. I think we see the same thing in the counseling revolution in the church, for example. There's a difference between getting counsel, which is a biblical thing to do, and getting counseling, which is oftentimes an end in itself. You don't really want counsel to go and apply and solve the problem. What you want is a shoulder to cry on for a fee.
That raises a question in my mind. Does a feminized church, does a church that is bereft of genuine biblical masculinity, have a different view of the root of our problems, that is sin?
Right, because when the problem is sin, you're dealing with rebellion. And when you're trying to confront rebellion, what that means is you're going to have a fight on your hands. When you're dealing with sickness, when you've bought into the therapeutic model, what's needed is a little TLC and understanding and care and working through the problems. And we see this therapeutic model applied to alcoholism, which used to be called drunkenness, to sex addiction, which used to be called adultery, and so forth. We're trying to turn everything into a disease or a problem that we can talk through. But the gospel, God did not send his son to die on a cross while knowing it would be possible to talk through these problems.
In other words, Jesus didn't come to say, now let's all sit around in a circle, hold hands and talk about how we feel about our sin.
Right. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prayed to get out of it, to get out of the cross. And he said, if there's any other way, could we do that? And God, by declining to answer that prayer, said in effect, there is no other way. If sinners are to be saved, it's going to have to be through the cross. Well, the cross is the place where sin was conquered, defeated, which is a military metaphor. Christ did not work through any issues on the cross. He triumphed over the devil.
I like the way you put that. He didn't work through any issues. Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, have we ended up then also with a demasculinized, a feminized Jesus from the pulpits in our Bible study?
Oh, absolutely. And this is where we have this notion of Christ who comes to earth to try to win a bride. We portray him as a loser who probably can't get a date, right? Instead of him coming as this glorious bridegroom and the church is this bride adorned as a bride for her husband, and he does what he does in glory and power and authority and confidence, we have hymns that say, softly and tenderly, Jesus is calling, come home, but you probably won't. You know, it's very sentimental and very, people come to Christ because they feel sorry for Jesus.
Oh, my goodness. So so Jesus is the guy who all the girls want to talk to about their problems, but none of them want to go out with him.
Exactly.
And he is the guy who, consequently, men in our culture, who still have some innate sense of masculinity, find, is it too harsh a word to say to find that feminized Jesus repulsive?
No, I don't think it's too harsh a word at all. I think many men have reacted away from the effeminate Jesus. And some of the pictures that you see in pietistic homes, some of the pictures you see of Jesus, he's got everything but a ribbon in his hair.
He's still got the beard, though, Doug.
Yeah. Nothing they can do about that.
Well, that's true, I guess. All right. Now, if we have a feminized church, a feminized proclamation of Christ, and and the next one I guess we need to ask about is in our everyday lives, in the Christian life, where are the symptoms of this loss of biblical masculinity to be seen?
Well, I think probably the most obvious area is the place where the loss of masculinity is going to show up first will be in the home, in marriages. When you look at America today and you recognize that there's no appreciable difference in the divorce rate between unbelievers and pop evangelicals, that tells you that we are not living in any kind of alternative way. We're not presenting the biblical Christian alternative. We're not presenting the biblical view of marriage. And this is because husbands abdicate their responsibility. And they abdicate their responsibility because they don't understand that masculinity is is the assumption of responsibility.
So to come back to that basic definition that you have returned to several times here, the assumption of responsibility.
Right.
Can we make a biblical case that that with that responsibility there is divine authority?
Yes. What this is I believe God, Jesus has told us that the way to authority in his kingdom is to become the servant of all. This is one of the gospel paradoxes. The way up is down and so forth. I believe that it's a biblical model to say that authority flows to those who take responsibility, and authority flees from those who demand it. So if people are grasping at authority, they're not imitating Christ. Christ emptied himself, took the form of a servant, and therefore God has given him a name that is above every name. So you have, just Easter was yesterday, we have this central triumph is at the heart of our faith. Christ humbled himself for the joy that was set before him, and then God vindicated him by exalting him. So the Bible says, humble yourself, you'll be exalted. Exalt yourself, you'll be humbled. Well, I don't believe husbands have understood the sacrificial nature of masculinity. And they either sit in the corner in their homes, in their marriages, feeling sorry for themselves, or they thump their chests and demand authority, in which case it flees from them. What they need to do is take responsibility, accept the servant's role, and God says that authority will flow to them.
Folks, I like the way this guy thinks. Doug Wilson is my guest. If you enjoy what we're doing during this hour, comparing and contrasting, along with Doug Wilson, this individualized, experiential, kind of pietistic pop Christianity, and how that differs from scriptural theology, the theology of the Reformation, and a genuine model of biblical masculinity, not only in our God and in our proclamation, our worship, but also in our Christian lives. If you're looking for more of this, you need to look into the additional resources that we have for you in our Issues Etc. journal. It contains a list of tape and book resources on American revivalism, What's Wrong with Evangelicalism, Non-Denominationalism, Seeker-Sensitive Christianity, and numerous other tape and book resources. So call during this break, 1-800-737-0172, and ask to receive a complimentary free copy of the Issues Etc. journal. The number again, 1-800-737-0172. I've written two articles in this latest journal. The first is titled The Gospel in the Background, where I take on that issue of seeker-sensitive Christianity, seeker-oriented evangelism. Does it result in the proclamation of the gospel more or less? And I've also written one called Is God Trying to Tell Us Something? We'll be right back after this break.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
What was it like to be a confessing Christian in Nazi Germany? What did Christians of conscience do when Hitler closed seminaries and silenced churches? How did German Christians react to the Jewish Holocaust? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You can order Till the Night Be Past by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Till the Night Be Past, The Life and Times of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a Christian pastor who's serving prison time in the country of Nepal. Despite his unjust sentence, he's staying encouraged. And he's taking a leadership role in the prison. His name is Manja, M-A-N-J-A. And please remember to pray for him. Manja was sentenced for his faith in the Himalayan country of Nepal, and he's been sharing Christ with other prisoners according to the ministry Gospel for Asia. He's remained patient and keeps busy weaving items like Nepali caps and purses. Manja's wife and children are also staying strong in Christ. His wife is enrolling in a Bible school sponsored by Gospel for Asia, and his children are doing well in their school despite the tough times. Pray for Manja's release, but also for Christ to keep working through him. Pray for hurting Christians around the world by logging on to the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Are you straining toward some goal in your life? And is getting there half the fun? Lance Armstrong, the world's current sports hero, tells about a journalist years ago who asked if I was entered in any of the spring classics. No, I said. Well, why not? I'm focusing on the tour. He kind of smirked at me and said, "Oh, so you're a tour rider now," like I was joking. Armstrong had a single-minded focus, and he won 5 times. What if you put forth all your energies but don't achieve your goal? Tears, dejection, and a painful reminder of the eternal order of things. God is God, we are not. He's unlimited in his abilities. Ours are quite limited. My time is not yet come, said Jesus. He had focus and he succeeded. And if you relate your life to him, you can still have hope and peace, even if the earthly goal is lost. Lance Armstrong used a phrase to describe his own pursuit, a peace in the simplicity of our dedication. You don't have to win to have that. I'm Dale Meyer.
I'm Emma Wilkin. Join me every weekday morning for a fun Bible quiz that kids, and only kids, can play. Listen for my question each morning at 9:05 during Paul Clayton's morning show. Call with the right answer and win. Winners of the Bible Brain Teaser for kids only will get cool prize packages from Concordia Christian Books and Gifts. It's the Bible Brain Teaser for kids only here on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, your host. We're talking about biblical masculinity during this hour of Issues Etc. with my guest, Doug Wilson. He's pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho, editor of Credenda Agenda magazine, and author of the book Future Men. If you have a question or comment for us, the number is 1-800-730-2727. I'd like to hear from some of you men. Do you have a hard time relating to your pastor, to what goes on in your wife's church? That's how you think about it, your wife's church. On Sunday morning, the Bible class, has it become feminized, kind of touchy-feely for you? What about you women? Have you ever wondered why you can't get your husband to go to church, except on Christmas and Easter, and even then, it's like pulling teeth, and then when he leaves, you can see it in his eyes. He's not coming back again until the next time you force him to do it. That's what we're talking about during this hour. 1-800-730-2727. Wouldn't you like your husband to get up on Sunday morning and he be the one who says, let's go to church? He be the one who insists on it? He be the one who gets those kids out of bed and says, children, it's time to go to church? Wouldn't that be nice? 1-800-730-2727. That's 1-800-730-2727. Well, Doug, some people have offered solutions to this problem. One of them, a men's movement, a Christian men's movement. Why don't we just start one like Promise Keepers? That'll get masculinity back into the church.
Well, unfortunately, although I think the Promise Keeper movement intended well or meant well at the beginning, I would want to argue that Promise Keepers is Exhibit B or C of the effeminacy of the modern church. Because what has happened is, a number of years ago, I wrote with a colleague of mine, David Agopian. We wrote a book called Beyond Promises, which was a biblical evaluation of the Promise Keeper movement. And the difficulty with Promise Keepers is that they have bought into the feminine model of how men ought to relate to one another. And instead of relating to one another as men do, they, in their small groups and in their materials and as they do what they do, they have adopted sort of an effeminate approach to masculine relationship. And it's really astounding. When we looked at the material, on marriage and how to put your marriage back together, one of the underlying assumptions is that your wife is right. The feminine perspective about your marriage is accurate, and you need to find out what she wants and give that to her. Well, of course, that doesn't mean some might object, well, you mean to say that the husband should get his way? No. Both husband and wife are Christians, and they're both under Christ's authority. And so they should find out what Christ wants the husband to do, and he should do that. The wife should find out what Christ wants from her, and she should do that, rather than being guilty of idolatry in our attempts at restoring marriages.
That's a very that's an insightful critique there, not only with regard to an effeminate kind of an effeminate masculinity, but also with regard to those personal relationships between the husband and the wife. Now, are you saying then that men can't talk to one another about their feelings? It should all be back slapping and cigar smoking?
No, but if they talk to one another about their feelings, they ought to do it the way men do it and have done it for thousands of years. Oftentimes, women don't object. One of the common critiques that women have of men is that they don't share their feelings. Well, of course, there are men who are head cases who don't share their feelings, but there are many men who do share their feelings, but they do it the way men do it. They don't do it the way women would do it. And if you can see the difference between men and women, this will illustrate it. Picture a book written by a man for a male audience and a book written by a woman for a female audience. And it could be a paperback throwaway, the You Got It Safeway, or it could be great literature. It could be The Odyssey or Pride and Prejudice, or it could be a gothic romance or a Louis L'Amour Western. In the book written by a man for men, the mission is the point. They want to get the gold back or the cattle back or spike the guns or win the battle. The mission is the point. And the woman, when she enters the book, is there to help win the mission, to help get the cattle back or the gold or whatever. In the book by a woman for women, the relationship is the plot. Men function shoulder to shoulder, and women function face to face. And I think the Apostle Paul teaches us this in 1 Corinthians 11, where he says, man was not created for the woman, but the woman for the man. And so she's oriented to him differently than he's oriented to her. Now, obviously, men need to be able to have close friendships, but their friendships will be different than two women who are equally good friends. They're not going to function the same way.
Okay, another issue, and this has to do with the church's general attitude as it has, evolved over the last several decades, maybe even centuries. I think Leon Poddle says the problem goes back 1,000 years in his book, The Feminization of the Church, The Church Impotent. But what about a church that is either, one, afraid of conflict, or, two, has labeled all conflict sinful?
Well, if you're afraid of conflict, if a pastor or a church is afraid of conflict, then I think they've found the wrong religion, because Jesus said he came not to bring peace on earth but a sword. He's promised us constant conflict. The Apostle Paul said it's through much tribulation that we enter the kingdom of heaven. There's conflict. We live in a sinful world. And at the very beginning of our sinful history, God has placed the antithesis between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. There's constant, total war between these two seeds. And fortunately, Christ, the ultimate seed of the woman, wins. He triumphs. But it's conflict. Put on the whole armor of God, Paul says. We're called to conflict.
Now, some would say, okay, yeah, but we should avoid as much as possible. And there's no problem with, like, setting out our doctrinal positions for everyone to see. We won't be shy about that, talking about what we do believe. But polemics, that makes me nervous. Let's not do that when we actually have to argue against someone else's position.
Right. The difficulty, again, with this is that it runs aground on the scriptural evidence. One of the things is, you know, when you go back to the time of the Reformation and look at how Luther and Calvin and the other reformers used to talk about their adversaries, it was not a collegial academic debate. Souls were at stake. Europe was at stake. Today, all sorts of things are debated in scholarly journals, and everybody thinks they have a fundamental duty to be nice and academic and polite. And if you're not, then someone's going to accuse you of being unchristlike. Well, the problem with this is how Christ used to talk. We know that the Pharisees are bad, but in the first century, the Pharisees had a great reputation, which Jesus trashed. Jesus, by his polemical teaching, and Matthew 23 is probably the principal example of it, where Jesus spends a whole chapter working over the Pharisees with a Louisville slugger. And the whole book of Amos is a satiric book. The Bible is a satiric book. And so basically the person who says, I want everything to be sweet and nice, is abandoning the Bible.
So if we're going to rediscover a genuine biblical masculinity for the church as individuals, but also for how the church does its job, which is proclaim Christ, it's going to mean that conflict is the order of the day?
Yes, it's the order of the day. Man is born to trouble, Job says, as the sparks fly upward. We want everything to be smooth, and in that desire, we have become faithless, because we are called to battle. We are Christians, and there is conflict between those who love God and those who hate him, and there's nothing we can do to eliminate that conflict. We can make decisions that affect what side we're on, but we don't have the option of becoming a non-combatant. There's no spiritual Switzerland.
That's another good one. I'm going to write that one down. It seems like a lot of churches just want to be, we're Switzerland, we're neutral, don't touch
right.
us. We won't hurt you, you don't hurt us. What would a Good Friday sermon then, I mean, we've just come off of Holy Week, what would a Good Friday sermon sound like in a feminized church?
Well, in a feminized setting, we would all feel sorry for Jesus. All right, Jesus ran afoul of the authorities. They killed him. And there would be an emotional identification with him in his death, in his suffering. Not that that by itself is bad. The problem is when there's nothing but that.
In other words, when this is kind of like poor Jesus.
Correct.
The poor Jesus sermon.
Right. So when I'm taking these swings at the effeminacy of the church, I'm by no means am taking swings at godly femininity. There's a place, a God-honoring place for women who serve God and who exercise their gifts. So this is not hostility to femininity at all. It's just that when it's all feminine, it's boring. That's not how God made us. He created us male and female. Masculine and feminine, in the same way that it's boring when it's all guys forever and ever.
So Jesus didn't go to the cross to win our sympathy. Do you think a Good Friday service in a feminized, kind of the typical pietistic pop evangelical church, would it leave out items like the blood, the sweat, the agony, the torture?
I think that that's sometimes minimized, or if it's emphasized, it's emphasized in order to elicit sympathy instead of awe and respect. Right, when I look at Christ on the cross, I should not think of someone who is getting mangled or caught up in the machinery. It's more like the end of Braveheart, where he is being tortured, but he triumphs anyway. When I look at the end of Braveheart, it's not the emotion that comes out is not sympathy, as it is awe, respect, honor.
My guest is Doug Wilson. We're talking about the feminization of the church and biblical masculinity. He's author of this book called Future Men. Yeah, Jesus didn't hang on the cross to win our sympathy. and he's not a victim of circumstance. This is a willful, obedient act that we are watching. And we are watching him contending, life contending with death, righteousness, obedience contending with rebellion and sin, God contending with Satan. That's what we're watching. We're watching conflict. And don't be mistaken that just because he ends up dead, don't judge him the victim then. He's the victor. It's an odd and strange way to gain victory, but that's what Christ has done for us on the cross. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this depiction of Christ in the proclamation of the church, but I also want to get into a few other things like praise and worship music and what I mentioned before by way of plugging our Issues Etc. journal, seeker-sensitive Christianity. That term sensitive seems a little suspicious to me. When we come back, we'll talk about that. Doug Wilson is my guest.
You're listening to Issues Etc. on the Jubilee Network.
Noted author and English professor Dr. Gene Edward Veith on why he joined the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
In my spiritual journey, I've been a mainline Protestant liberal. I flirted with Eastern mysticism, and I've been involved with American evangelicalism. But it was through the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that I discovered what the grace of God really means, what Jesus really accomplished for me on the cross, and how, in his word and sacraments, Jesus really comes into my life. A lot of people are looking for the right church, one that has the theological substance and the depth that is sometimes hard to find in American Christianity. Some of them are looking in all different kinds of directions, and they're really looking for is Lutheranism.
If you want to learn more about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, call our Issues Etc. resource line at 1-800-737-0172 and ask to receive a free pamphlet called What About the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? 1-800-737-0172.
If you'd like to know how to purchase Doug Wilson's book called Future Men, the number to call, toll-free, 1-800-488-2034. That's 1-800-488-2034. 34. By the way, we got a couple people waiting here to talk. I've got a few things to get out here. I cannot promise we'll get to you, but we will do our very best in the next 10 minutes to get to those phone calls. The next issue, and you've touched upon this earlier in our conversation, Doug, and that is praise and worship music, which seems at the very least to be aimed at stirring the emotions in the worshiper. How would you evaluate that?
Well, blurt it out if you don't mind. Most praise and worship music today is what I think could be aptly called Jesus is my girlfriend music. And if you take the kind of music, the lyrics and the music that are being sung about Jesus, and you substitute for Jesus Sheila or something like that.
Tammy. Yeah.
Yeah, Sammy, Sheila, Jesus is my girlfriend, Jesus is my boyfriend. The song still works. Okay?
What does that tell you?
That tells me that the music has been dragged down into onto a human level. There's no transcendent glory here. It's been dragged down to a human level, and that human level is sentimental and effeminate. If you tried to do that with a hymn like Immortal, Invisible, God Only Wise, you couldn't do it. It wouldn't work.
But, you know, it's not only the modern contemporary praise and worship music. You mentioned before Softly and Tenderly, but you also mentioned in your book In the Garden, it's almost a romantic encounter with Jesus, a tryst there in the beauty of the garden.
That's exactly right, yes. And basically, this problem didn't develop in 1964 when the Beatles came to America. This is a standing problem in the church, as the Church Impotent points out, going back to Bernard of Clairvaux. But in our time, it's accelerated in our time. Anne Douglas wrote an outstanding book called The Feminization of American Culture, and she points out how a lot of what we call traditional values today, conservative traditional values, are actually the early forms of feminism.
What's the point there? What does that mean?
Well, what that means is, for example, going back to the era of In the Garden, or the era of all the books, the Elsie Dinsmore books and In His Steps, that kind of thing, with where the WWJD thing all came from. When you look at that, you see that the converting influence in these books is always the feminine presence, right? The feminine is the standard. And this was an early form of feminism where the feminism was domestic, not as opposed to career-minded, but it was feminism nonetheless.
Okay, I see what you're saying there. What about seeker-sensitive worship? We could debate whether or not there's any such thing as a genuine seeker out there,
sure.
Depending on how you want to define it. But the second term there in that kind of standard term of art for church growth is sensitive. Does
right.
that give you pause?
Yes, it does, because I think there's a dictum in business that is right, and that is the customer is always right. And if the seeker off the street is the customer, then he's going to be right. You're going to have a demographically driven church, and the statement of faith, the confession, the liturgy, everything's up for grabs. Now, I do believe that the customer is always right. It's just that I believe that God's the customer.
So when we say we really ought to turn that around and talk about perhaps maybe sinner-sensitive worship or sinner-oriented worship, or maybe even better yet, Savior-oriented worship.
Yes. I sometimes joke that our church service is seeker hostile.
But God-friendly? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Basically, the problem that confronts us is not how we get sinners to accept God. The problem that confronts us in Scripture is how can we get God to accept sinners? The answer to that question is the cross.
What about gender-neutral Bibles, Doug? There's a big huff and puff going on about today's new international version that's changed some pronouns to make them more gender inclusive.
Yeah, I think that this is another example of everybody falling all over themselves in order not to offend anybody, and this is another indicator of the effeminacy of the church. And this is somewhat tongue in cheek, but I'm all in favor of evangelicals having a gender-neutral Bible, because it's been 100 years since evangelicals have had any testosterone at all, and it's about time they had a Bible to match.
Ordination of women. I observed to an emailer late last week who was concerned that we'd had a lady on the air to talk about baptism, and she had written an article for one of the journals out of one of our seminaries. And he was concerned that she might be a pastor, and I said, we do not ordain women in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because women cannot be called to the pastoral office. It's that simple. Scripture lays the bounds there. But there are denominations that have ordained women, and now they're all talking about ordaining homosexuals. Is there a link here?
Yes, there is. And part of the reason we have why the evangelicals are going to have an impossible time on the ordination of women issue is because we have placed feminine virtues on a pedestal with regard to pastors. We require pastors to act like women. And after we've done that for enough decades, someone's going to point out that women could do a better job acting like women than men can, which is quite true.
Well, and if we still want men in the pulpit, then a gay man will certainly exemplify. I mean, if Will and Grace or all the other television shows tell us anything, it's that gay men are extremely sensitive. And
right.
and they're extraordinarily good at dealing with people.
Right. Exactly.
Our phone number, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Kurt. Kurt, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Pastor Wilson, I'm the father of two boys, and so I bought your book, Future Men. In that book, you say that the most important things to teach boys doctrinally are the sovereignty of God and optimism. I forget how you said it. Did you mean by that optimistic eschatology, and how would you define that?
Well, I did have eschatology in mind, but I don't mean by optimistic eschatology, the thing I don't mean in the first place is a particular view of the train schedules of the thing, if you know what I mean. I'm not so much concerned about pre, post, awe, that sort of thing. Although I am a post-millennialist, that's not the main thing. The main thing is that I believe that God has called us to be faithful in this world, and I believe that he's called us to preach the gospel in a triumphal way in this world, and that we should do so preparing to disciple the nations.
One last issue that you raise in your book, and it has to do, you talk about it in the context of raising young men and boys, but I think it also applies to the feminization of the church, and that is this trend toward terminal trendiness, this desire to be hip and cool, to be with it. It seems that the church, and in particular some of its pastors, that seems to drive the agenda. Let's be with it, let's be cool, let's not appear square at all.
Right. And basically, that sort of Me Too-ism is the kind of thing that shows that there's no real leadership here. It's not, and leadership is masculine. Courage is a masculine virtue.
Let's come back to the cross then, with about a minute left here. What are we watching? We're watching a man die for us. And this establishes a relationship with sinners once and for all. The church's proclamation of that cross, say it in the most, well, biblically masculine way it can be proclaimed.
Well, Christ died to secure the salvation of his people. He didn't die to try anything. He wasn't attempting anything. He was accomplishing something. When Jesus died, the thing he said right before he died was, "It is finished." He didn't say, "It has begun. Let's hope it works."
Doug Wilson, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
My pleasure.
Doug Wilson is pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. He's editor of Credenda Agenda magazine and author of the book Future Men. You can get this book by calling 1-800-488-2034. That's 1-800-488-2034. Also, if you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of this program, or if you'd like to receive a complimentary copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to make a credit card donation to Issues Etc., all you have to do is call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Well, the evidence is all around us, folks. This is what we're faced with as a church. And we can either say, well, this is good. You know, this is how we're going to reach people with the saving message of Christ, is by let's eschew the masculine and pursue the feminine here. If the diagnosis is correct, and I believe it is. But what kind of Christ are we going to end up with when we finally get around, after being sensitive and careful and non-confrontational, what Jesus will there be to present to a world that is in a death and life struggle? And death is winning. Sin is taking over. What Jesus will there be to present? Will it be the Jesus who accomplished our salvation at the cross? Think about it. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO, join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll talk with Scott Drawn about the recent laws regarding downloading or file sharing music on the Internet. He is a lawyer. We'll also talk with Dr. Greg Cinnamon, who's the author of Discover Your Child's DQ Factor, the Discipline Quotient System. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee.